Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Friday night on The Money Show. The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, delivering world-class foreign exchange execution and hedging expertise. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. We'll chat to Tato Mashego this evening, the portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. News coming out of the United States tonight that the Fed is ready to start cutting the stimulus that's been pouring into the U.S. economy since the start of this particular crisis. And as a result of that, we're going to see some interesting moves happening on markets and currencies, no doubt, in the next couple of weeks. Mitch Slape, the chief executive of Massmart, standing by. Catch up with him. We've seen two broad appeals for crowdfunding this week. One by the Jacob Zuma Foundation to keep funding Jacob Zuma's, appearances, legal fees. That's what we're looking for. Not funding his delays, because that would be money, good money thrown after bad. But also the ANC looking to crowdfund for salaries. How can crowdfunding be used in this way? It's not what it was designed for, but could it be used in this way? Best bits after 7 o'clock, and of course the brutal biz quiz wrapping up the first hour of this evening's Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
So very modest sales growth for the 6 months to the end of June for Massmart, up 4.4% to just over 41 billion rand. Company announcing this week plans to sell off its fresh foods business to ShopRite for just over a billion rand, and a planned acquisition of its own to boost online shopping. It all seems to be going in the right direction. Mitch Slape, the chief executive at Massmart, is on the line to us from Johannesburg this evening. You're seeing your costs being cut, your margins are ticking up, and you are getting a better trading result. Mitch, good evening.
Evening, Bruce. Thanks for having me. And yes, we're excited about some of the progress that we're seeing in our turnaround plan. And I think that the half-year results are indicative that, you know, we continue to do a workmanlike job of producing improvements in various metrics in the business.
And, I mean, how much of an uphill slog is it, particularly in times of COVID?
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, we are in one of the most demanding and challenging trading environments that I think I've ever seen in my career. You know, you have on top of COVID, you have disruptions to liquor sales. You've got a very poor demand in food, liquor, consumables among our wholesale customers. If you think about hotels, restaurants, catering, tourism, you've got a very constrained lower-income and middle-income consumer, tough environment. But what we're trying to do is focus on those things that we can control. And it's getting the fundamentals of the business right. It's getting gross profit right. It's getting expense right. And, you know, I firmly believe that the sales environment will improve in the future, and we want to be ready for it when it does.
How are supply chains performing in terms of getting products through from places like China? So much of the stuff that we consume nowadays does come from China. We've seen microchip shortages affect everything from PS4s and 5s and televisions and absolutely everything in the world, of course. How are those supply chains holding up?
So I would say moderately well. We continue to have pressure, and certainly there are a variety of global demand issues that are impacting supply chain. There are certainly pricing, particularly in various commodities that are impacting supply chain. But we continue to perform reasonably well in that space. And, you know, right now what we're mostly focused on with supply chain is getting ourselves back in stock with many of the imported goods that wound up being looted or destroyed as part of the unrest back in July.
That unrest, I mean, you didn't have the same number of shops damaged and destroyed, but because of the scale of your operations, of course, the impact was absolutely enormous. Have you come to a final number on what that has cost?
So we're still working on the level of damages in property and also the level of damages in business interruption overall. But we did share today that we're estimating about 1.3 billion rand in inventory loss as a result of looting. So we have zeroed in on that figure. But as you would know, and this is a lengthy process to work through damage assessment, working with the insurers, and we're very much in the midst of that process right now.
And there is, of course, the lost sales into the future as you rebuild and restock and decide how you are going to structure those businesses into the future. I mean, when you look at their way where they're located and how vulnerable they were, are you rethinking the footprint of Massmart stores into the future, or will you simply build on the rubble of the old?
So we are going to take a look in certain cases at opportunities to locate stores in new locations that may open up new market opportunities, but within the same basic trade area that we were serving before. Also looking at opportunities to potentially maybe take market share by adding an additional store in certain locations. I would say the biggest focus, though, is really making sure that we're examining the security, what I would call the security perimeter, particularly for large distribution centers or warehouses, larger stores, to make sure we really think through the contingencies and use the learnings from July so that we're in a better position if those events were to ever occur in the future.
So much of what happens in retail happens behind the scenes in terms of warehousing and logistics and the really important stuff where cents are saved and it turns to billions later. Nothing much that the customer sees. How much are you changing of the customer experience of the various Massmart brands?
So in terms of the customer experience, I believe we've got a very good customer value proposition in our lead businesses. So if you look at Builders, just incredible strength coming out of that business. In fact, in the first half, we saw trading profit up 184% in Builders versus prior year and well ahead of the 2019 pre-COVID numbers as well. The same in our wholesale businesses, very strong in macro. Cash and carry is performing very well for us right now. Where we're really working on the customer proposition is in game. And we've done a number of interventions during the course of this year where we're effectively touching every store in South Africa, relaying it, improving assortments, working on our customer service protocols. So really trying to make an improved and better experience for our core customers there.
And a big focus into the future on online and home delivery. You released a statement this week saying that you're in advanced stages of negotiations with a business called OneCart, clearly keen to buy that, and also bringing in a top Walmart executive to tackle the issues domestically of online and home delivery.
Absolutely. If you think about the future of retail, 5, 10, 20 years into the future, there's no doubt it's going to become increasingly digital, increasingly online, and we want to be ready for that. And we want to be able to meet the customer where they want to be met. And that means that we need to leverage our physical assets in our stores to be there for our customers for things like click and collect. But at the same time, our customers may want delivery. And as I think about the OneCart opportunity, it really is one of adding a building block to what I think is going to become a formidable e-commerce structure in the future for Massmart. And we certainly like the company, we like the opportunity, and we're excited about it.
Thank you to Mitch Slape this evening, Chief Executive Officer at Massmart.
702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
Well, two desperate cash-seeking appeals this week, both of them looking for your money. One of them from the Jacob Zuma Foundation looking for money for his legal fees. The second, a suggestion by the ANC that it might be obliged to go to its members to crowdfund for salaries of staff who this week picketed because they weren't being paid. Derek Whitehead, Operations Director at Jumpstart Crowdfunding. Derek, welcome to the Money Show. Crowdfunding, I don't think traditionally originally was designed as a cash-raising exercise for consumption spending. Usually, crowdfunding is to fund a bright idea to create a brand new business, but are there rules attached to crowdfunding?
Hi, Bruce. Thank you very much for having me. So the basic dynamic is crowdfunding is a way to raise money from a large number of people. And large groups of people pull together small individual investments to provide the capital needed to get the company or the project off the ground. So obviously individual charities or companies can create a campaign for specific causes and anyone can contribute. On the political side, there can be overlaps, it depends, but the basic dynamic is support from a group of people.
So it's entirely feasible, therefore, that the Jacob Zuma fan club might want to keep funding his legal fees in perpetuity, because we know that he's not that keen on appearing in court and answering to legal charges. He's been pretty adept at delaying the process, and that's why he's spent as much money as he has and owes as much money as he does on legal fees. But it's entirely feasible that if enough people cared enough about Jacob Zuma's legal outcomes, that they could band together.
Look, that is true. You know, if there's a big enough group and they pull together and they've got enough resources, they can get it done. At the same time, there are different types of crowdfunding. There are four different types. There's simple donation-based crowdfunding where people donate from the goodness of their heart for the specific cause or charity. There's reward-based crowdfunding, which our company Jumpstart is, where people donate to unlock a specific reward linked to the project they support. And there's obviously also the equity-based crowdfunding, which provides opportunities for people to invest in private companies. And investors receive this promise of stock, future shares, or another security issued by the company in exchange for capital. And there's obviously also debt-based crowdfunding, where it's almost like peer-to-peer lending, which allows individuals to obtain loans directly from other individuals without a bank or financial institution acting as a middleman. So when you're talking about what JPEG Zuma is potentially looking at, I would lean, I don't know, potentially something like donation-based crowdfunding. But then again, it comes down to how they want to put something together like that. And if there's a big enough group that will be able to help with a larger amount needed by him.
No, absolutely. Because, I mean, you kind of think, well, lots of people might want to give money, and that's fine. So I give 10 bucks, somebody else gives 100. It takes an awful lot of those kind of donations to lead to a million, 2 million, 5 million, 10, 20, 30 million rand that you might require, depending on the extent of your problem.
Exactly that. And if you're going bigger numbers, it's going to be more difficult with a small group of people. Unless it's a really large group, and unless also companies get involved, which can sort of provide the larger amounts needed. So once again, it really comes down to what the project or what the whole initiative is about and the support that can be gained from it.
What about something like salaries? I mean, crowdfunding something like salaries, I might be able to crowdfund enough for this month's salary, but I still haven't solved the underlying structural problems to raise revenue, so I'd then have to re-crowdfund for the month after salaries and the month after salaries. Can the systems of crowdfunding sustain those sorts of regular contributions? Or I just think people eventually get fed up, but that's my outside perspective. I don't know just how generous and kind-hearted ANC benefactors can be for how long.
Exactly that. Look, generally, in South Africa, people are wary about money online. We are, I wouldn't say we are a first world country, but, you know, there needs to be something for people to want to pledge money online. Our team believes that reward-based crowdfunding would work well because it incentivizes people to open up their wallets, whether it be an individual or a company, and pledge towards a campaign and in return get a reward. You know, once again, it comes down, donation-based crowdfunding is simply giving from the goodness of your heart because you believe in a cause, you believe it's a good thing to do. So once again, with you talking about the political arena, there are some steps you need to take to be aware of, you know. Once again, it comes down to having a big enough support group to raise the large amount of capital needed to answer the question. So there's a few different maneuvers, but
you do sound somewhat skeptical about the likely success.
To a degree, look. I've got to tread carefully when it comes to politics, talking hard on in a public space. But at the same time, if there is if there is a big enough group and they are willing to support, then something like that can be done. At the same time, you also need to have a chosen platform that also can work. But like I said, the basic dynamic is having a big enough support group that can obviously pledge to make something like this happen.
Thank you, Derek Whitehead, Operations Director, Jumpstarter Crowdfunding. Yeah, somewhat skeptical that South Africans are going to be necessarily that keen to commit money, donating the money, reward-based. What reward could you get from the J.G. Zuma Foundation? A guided tour of Nkandla, perhaps? I don't know. But yeah, I remain skeptical. I wish them luck with it. And if you feel that your supporters have got the wherewithal to make the right donations, be my guest. Jesse Duarte on Clement's show this morning on 702 on the issue of salary payments, saying that the ANC just does not have the money to pay salaries. And she's saying as management, they haven't been paid since May. And they're considering crowdfunding from members. Clement asked for a commitment to pay, and she says, "I can't answer you. There is just no money." When the ANC money taps got switched off with the blocking of so much of the benefactors and the anonymity of donations, with new legislation that requires declaration of where money comes from and who's making donations to political parties, this is seriously causing big problems, not only for the party's former leader, but for the party itself.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Markets had a very, very good day. But a bigger story right now than just our local market is Jerome Powell, who's chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve. There is a gathering that happens once a year at a place called Jackson Hole in Wyoming in the United States. It's where central bankers from around the world meet to talk about the state of the world. They're meeting virtually, as people are nowadays. And today, Jerome Powell has been talking about the inflation picture in the United States being sufficient for them to start a tapering process. Tato Mashiko is portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. In English, basically what Jerome Powell is saying is, we're going to stop pumping American taxpayers' money into the U.S. economy.
Good evening, Bruce. The annual Jackson Hole event did occur virtually. It's just not quite the same, I suppose, as being in scenic location, but be that as it may, everyone's eyes were focused on Jerome Powell in the less than scenic location that he was in this time. And he did declare that the Fed is seriously considering reducing its monthly $120 billion asset purchase program. And this obviously was taken quite well by the market, especially so since he did not tie in the reduction in potential asset purchases with a future increasing raising of rates. And so the two are going to be looked at separately, which means that potential rate hikes may not be as soon as some people are expecting. And we've seen the Rand recover quite strongly now at 14.7 on the back of that, and looking positive, we can say.
I was interested because I always thought that tapering was an indication of stability and strength in the U.S. economy, and therefore interest rates would start going up. It's that separation of interest rate announcement and future interest rate decisions with this funding of asset purchases that is separated, which has given, I think, Rand bulls a little bit of comfort. The Rand is strengthening about 1.25% this afternoon down to 14.73. It's quite a big recovery on the week, actually.
It definitely is. And if you recall the taper tantrum of 2013, when the market was caught by surprise with the Fed deciding that they would start reducing the asset purchase program, I think they've been at extreme pains to avoid a similar fate this time around. And given that employment has been better than expected, as we've seen in jobs reports recently, and the inflation outlook seems to be heading in the direction that the Fed wants it to, remember that they are not afraid of inflation being more or less above their 2% target in the interim period, as long as it is transitory, and we all have different definitions of transitory. But the market is kind of seeing this as a positive sign, that things are on the positive in terms of momentum, and not necessarily leading to raising rate hikes, which would obviously have an impact on asset prices and equities, which are at record highs at the moment.
It's been a busy week for Massmart. Massmart came out with the announcement of the asset sales to ShopRite of the food businesses, and then announced the imminent one-cart deal, and results out today. Market's not overwhelmed by Massmart's promise of turnaround.
Well, indeed, the outlook for Massmart is obviously quite muted, just given COVID unrest and rising unemployment. But on the positive side, one can say that if you split out continuing and discontinued sales, then what remains in Massmart, excluding the food businesses, which they're selling to ShopRite, the likes of MassCash and the others, Rhino, it doesn't look particularly bad, although overall Massmart has had a very torrid time over the past 2 years. So the continuing ramp of the business on a same-store sale basis was up 6.6%. Discontinued business, which is the food section, down 10%. And obviously that's speaking to their inability to reach profitability in the food business, given all the headwinds we've seen recently. On a positive side, liquor sales, in line with all the other retailers, did exceptionally well. Macro liquor up 50% year-on-year. And Builders Warehouse, in line with the theme that we've seen on Mr. Price and others, up 25%. So I suppose one could say, well, they haven't been able to get the best out of their food assets. They are offloading them to ShopRite. Going forward, the outlook is quite negative from a macro perspective, but hopefully we will start seeing some value uplift in the company.
When you say it's negative from a macro perspective, you mean with a small M and a C, not a big M and a K, right? Macro is actually doing all right. Okay, just getting absolute clarity. Getting absolute clarity. Local retail took a bit of a knock today. Woolies has outperformed this week. I mean, Woolies really is getting some wind in its sails. We spoke to Roy Bacchettini, the chief executive, there last night, and he really does seem to have grabbed Woolies by the scruff of its neck and done some big shaking.
Well, indeed, and it's always been, I suppose, a tale of two businesses, so to speak, with the food and clothing, and the clothing business needing quite a bit of restructuring, and well, the food business already doing well, but some new exciting initiatives being introduced there as well. And it seems that the never-ending disaster, which has been the Australia adventure, is coming to a close, not just on the clothing, but on the food side as well. And we know that how much trouble they've had with clothing with David Jones and them trying to bring Australian look into SA and SA look into Australia, and neither really worked at all. So all of that is seemingly coming to an end. On the positive side, they mentioned on the beauty side they're taking market share away from Edgar's, so that is quite positive, quite a high-margin business there. On the downside, we know that ShopRite is moving into Willy's turf, so to speak, with their high-end Fresh X brand, and so there may be some margin pressure going forward there if we start seeing more competition and pricing pressure from the two going forward. But some of the new initiatives like Willy's Dash, you may have seen some of the employees in the stores busy delivering to people at home. And there's obviously some teething issues there in terms of how to scale, but that could in the long term be quite an interesting proposition. They're closing down on the forecourt. They haven't seemed to have done as well as they would have expected, but this wasn't a large part of the business. So quite a bit going on at the moment in Woolies, but looking quite positive in terms of the changes that are being made.
Tato, thank you very much indeed. Tato Mashego is a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, offering world-class foreign exchange execution and hedging expertise. That's African Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
This is The Money Show, and coming up still in the next hour, we're going to be talking about a new concept of delivering Cup Classique to your door. Plus, we're going to play the Brutal Biz Quiz. But coming up on the next Money Show, we'll look at the hospitality and leisure sector with Anthony Leeming, the Sun International Group Chief Executive. And on Other People's Money, we've got the legendary Abdullah Ibrahim. He's the country's most distinguished pianist, a world-respected master musician. Also, all the top business and financial news of the day.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
A little bit of Mannenberg in the background. Now, I know it's hard to believe, but spring is, I swear, I promise you, spring is round the corner. But there's snow on the mountains of the Western Cape. It's causing temperatures to plummet. The cold front that brought this massive dump of snow over the last day in the Western Cape, moving over toward Gauteng this weekend with sub-zero temperatures predicted for Sunday. But you know what they say? Failure to plan is planning to fail. So what you need to do is be planning for spring because it is on its way. Eli Yannikaris is the co-founder of Bubbly Box. And Eli, I saw a quote from Lily Bollinger of the famous family that created some of the world's greatest champagne. And she was saying, "I drink champagne when I am happy and when I am sad. Sometimes I drink when I'm alone. When in company, I consider it obligatory. I trifle with it if I'm not hungry, and I drink it when I am." Do you feel the same way about Cup Classique?
Oh, absolutely. Every moment in the day is a moment for Cup Classique.
Oh, my goodness me. Have you seen somebody about that, Eli? Have you seen somebody about that?
We need to celebrate all the moments.
Completely, and there is actually nothing as that signifies celebration, and it's been bred into us through Hollywood. It's been bred into us over generations that there is nothing like a celebration with a sparkling wine, whether it be champagne or whether it be Cup Classique. You and a couple of friends got together, I'm not too sure when, and decided that you needed a project. Tell me about how you started Bubbly Box.
Yeah, so you know it's that age-old story where a passion becomes a business. And a couple of years ago, we were colleagues. We got together for a dinner and we chose a theme. And that theme happened to be we were going to bring a Cup Classique that no one had tried before. And the aim was to bring something that was under 100 rand that might age us a little. And we loved the evening so much that we decided to start a bubbly club. And every 6 weeks we would meet and try and bring something new that we hadn't tried before. And over time, people would say, "Oh, please, can we join your bubbly club?" And we ourselves discovered how many amazing Cup Classiques there were that people hadn't even heard of. And so we decided we all have entrepreneurial experience, and we decided to start Bubbly Box as a way of bringing all those undiscovered gems together in one place so that people could discover them. And so now we have South Africa's only online store exclusively for Cup Classique.
I think it started, I think Simon Sich was the first, and they launched Karps of Funkel. Because there was, I mean, Niederberg used to make something called Cup Sekt, which I think was just gas infused into wine. But this was the first time anybody followed the French principles of actually leaving the yeast on the lees and tipping the bottle half upside down and going through an extensive multi-year process of natural fermentation to get natural bubbles into the wine. How many brands do we have? How many labels do we have in South Africa?
Well, you're right. The Simon Sich was the first official Cup Classique in 1971. And you may know it's the 50th anniversary of Cup Classique this year. And in fact, the 1st of September is Cup Classique Day. As far as we know, there are over 100 members who belong to the Cup Classique Association. So they officially produce in the Cup Classique method. And we have seen over 110, I think that was our last count. So there is a lot of Cup Classique to try.
Have you tried every
single one? And as you mentioned, no, we're too early in the day still to have tried all of those, but that's definitely the aim, is to be able to try them all. And list them all too.
I interrupted you. You were about to make a poignant point.
I was going to say that, I mean, as you explained, it is a real labor of love that a Cup Classique goes through the fermentation in the bottle and this happens over a period of time. And so the winemaker, there's a real skill and a passion involved. And so you start to understand why it is such a special craft and why it really is something to be savored.
Bottle for bottle, and in terms of quality, I'm astounded at the price point at which South African Cup Classique is retailed. It's pricey, but it's nowhere near what you're paying. You're paying, you know, for a great Cup Classique, you're paying a third of what you're paying for a French import.
Absolutely, and I think it's a testament to the winemakers and the industry here, but they definitely are on a par with the international champagnes. And it's made in the same method, and we have incredible vineyards here. And as South Africans, we actually are spoiled for choice. So we it's our go-to. We only drink Cup Classique, and I think there are incredible vintages also that are available. So for whatever it is, a special celebration, an occasion, a conversation, there's definitely something, an incredible quality and, as you say, affordable options for not only South Africans, but it's one of the biggest growth sectors in terms of export as well.
Now, wine clubs were a big thing at one time. Your club is different in that it's purely focused on Cape sparkling wine, on Cup Classique. How do you choose what goes into the box? Because I think you release, what, 4 boxes a year or 5 boxes a year. You're not sort of flooding your members, you're not oversupplying your members.
And it was interesting. I mean, Bruce, you know the entrepreneurial journey very well. And our original idea was to be able to offer a collection box. But as you start to explore logistics and business models, we realized that what we wanted to make available was an online store with a big range for people to be able to choose from at any time, especially around celebrations and occasions, and then to offer then the curated collection quarterly. And that's the fun part. We've just launched the first one we had was the Women Winemakers Collection, which was around Women's Month and really celebrating Women's Day. And our next one will be around the festive season. So we'll probably do it a little bit before Christmas so that you could always get a sample box of bubbies you'd love to serve at your Christmas or New Year's celebrations. And then there's other themes. You know, we could look at going some of the eco, the Cup Classiques that are made in more environmentally sustainable ways, ones that are made with zero dosage, for example. So if you're looking for lower sugar ones, we could even look per region, so possibly looking at themes of Cup Classiques coming out of some of the different regions. So the options are endless, actually. That's going to be a lot of fun for us to choose our different collection cases.
Is it a business or a passion project? Because when you talk to the wine buyers at Macro, they've got such extraordinary scale and buying power that they're buying for less than you can buy it from the farm. I mean, are you getting a deal from the wine producers so that you can add a bit of a margin to make it worthwhile into a business? Or is this just something of love and joy and passion and an excuse to get together once a quarter to try whatever's new in the market?
Look, I mean, we have to treat it as a business. You know, having an online store, having a broad range of bubblies available, you know, you have to do the numbers. And it is it's a sector that, you know, as you know, it's really suffered this year. So there are the margins. We have to be very realistic about them. So as much as this is a passion project, we're also hoping to grow this into something that is really a great offering in the Cup Classique sector. And so right now I think it's we're still having a lot of fun, and it definitely is something we're very passionate about, but we are looking at this and the viability of it, and looking forward for it to be something that's around for a while.
It's a fabulous initiative. Ellie, thank you very much for chatting to us this evening. Ellie Yannikaris, who is the co-founder, one of four, of Bubbly Box. You'll find their details on bubblybox.co.za, and it's all about celebrating Cup Classique. And once a quarter, a box finds its way to you of curated bubbles. And yeah, with 110 individual labels, if you like, in South Africa. You need all the help you can get in terms of defining in this 50th anniversary year of Cup Classique what is good and what is less good, but a lot of it is brilliant. Now, Brutal Biz quiz time on a Friday night. I'd love you to play. 011-883-0702. Get in nice and early. 021-446-0567. What is the full name of the FSCA? The FSCA, Foxtrot, Sierra, Charlie, Alpha. What is the full name of the FSCA? Come and play the Brutal Biz quiz this Friday night on 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, offering world-class foreign exchange execution and hedging expertise. That's African Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Brutal Biz quiz time on a Friday night. Kolisani in Pretoria. What is the full name of the FSCA?
Hi, Bruce. It stands for Financial Sector Conduct Authority.
10 out of 10 for that one, Kolisani. Congratulations. Suspending the exchange license of Czar X this week, much to their annoyance. Which company makes Savannah, Clipdrift, and Amarula?
South African Breweries.
No! Kolisani, but thank you for playing. Kolani in Pretoria. Pretoria is coming up big this evening. Which company makes Savannah, Clipdrift, and Amarula?
Distell.
Distell is absolutely right. This week, Distell reporting really good profit growth, and it's still in talks to be sold to Heineken. Potential takeover coming through there. What is the official currency of India?
The rupee.
The rupee is absolutely right. Reserve Bank of India may launch its first digital currency trial programs by December. Central banks, including those of China, Europe, and the UK, are exploring digital currencies. South Africa has also said it might look at a digital rand as well. Which South African retailer owns David Jones in Australia?
Woolworths.
I cannot defeat you. You are undefeatable. You are unbeatable. You are the whiz of the Brutal Biz quiz on this Friday night. Well done, Chukwani. You may now go to your local t-shirt shop, your local print shop, and say, please may I make for myself a t-shirt that says, I'm the whiz of the biz quiz. I defeated the whizzes of the biz quiz, and I am the winner. Too many words, perhaps. You can make up your own. But well done, Chukwani in Pretoria, this evening. The whiz of the Brutal Biz quiz on this Friday. The Money Show, of course, brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, delivering world-class foreign exchange execution and hedging expertise, the bravery to imagine. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.